Everybody thinks that, especially with the internet, it's easy to make money. You can log on and Amazon or Walmart will put you in business tomorrow. It is still hard work. It is still people-centric. It is still customer service focused. I still think people invest in people. And so if you're willing to do the work, I think there's still a lot of room for entrepreneurs out there.
Let's play a quick little game of brand association. So I'm going to name a product type or category, and I want you to think of a specific retail store. We're not talking e-commerce right now, specifically brick and mortar chain retail. So when I say books, what chain store do you think of? Electronics. Furniture. Baseball caps or hats. For me, the last one, baseball caps or hats, is Lids. It was an iconic store when I was growing up. It was in every mall. It was in every city. It was a store that popped up and scaled fast. Like 100 new stores a year fast at one point. To be able to scale a company that fast while making sure that your employee hiring and training processes stay consistent, your customer experience and satisfaction stays top-notch, your logistics and operations stays flowing, is not an easy feat. Today's guest, the co-founder of Hat World Lids, is going to walk us through his entrepreneurial journey, going from sleeping in the back of the first store, hoping that this idea that he and his co-founder had would make it, to building and growing a global empire across multiple countries. You had an entrepreneurial journey. It's not over yet, but you had an entrepreneurial journey that, you know, people dream about. Lids, Hat World Lids, grew to be international, many, many stores. But I'm a little curious, was Lids your first business endeavor? Like, what were you doing before you actually started Lids?
That's a great question. I graduated college in 1987 here in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And I went into business. I didn't own any businesses, but I ran a grocery store while I went to college. So that's how I put myself through college. And then I got out and I wanted to have some sort of retail store. So I actually went to work for Foot Locker. And they had a great training program. I have no idea what it is now, but back in the 80s, they were the creme de la creme. Everybody wanted to work for Foot Locker. So I went to work for Foot Locker in 1987. And by 1990, I had my own store. And that's really where I learned retail. I learned the art of dealing with people, hiring people, finding the right people, surrounding yourself with the right people. I learned what a profit and loss statement was. I learned inventory control, shrink control, anything and everything. They had about a 2-year training program. And if you were willing to put the work in, you would have a store. And so that's what I did. So I worked hard, got a store, and I was successful. Heck, I was manager of the year a handful of times. I was manager of the region in the central region. And we were based in Indianapolis, and we were beating up on stores in Chicago and New York. And so it was really the springboard for me to want to do more, want to be an entrepreneur. And so when I saw all the money I was making for Woolworth at the time, who owned Foot Locker. And when I saw all the money, you know, I saw the profit and loss statements, and I knew a lot of that was because of the things I had done, the way I had trained people, the lessons I had taught them, things like that. So it just kind of fueled the fire for me to want to be an entrepreneur. So that was kind of my early journey into what started as, Hat World Lids.
Yeah. And when you were talking with your co-founders, you had two co-founders, right?
I had two co-founders. So when I was in Indianapolis with the Foot Locker, I met some great people, and I was a manager trainer. And in a district, you had one or two manager trainers. And my good friend, Scott Molander, happened to be one of the manager trainers. So he and I, we talked all the time. We traveled together. We'd go out and train other managers. And so, we were driving one day up to Kokomo, Indiana. I'll never forget. And I had a little blue pickup truck. And I said, man, we need to start something. I mean, you and I are pretty talented. People like us. We've been successful. What if we start something and we kind of kick some things around? And I said, man, I've seen a couple of these hat stores around. At the time, I'd seen a Hat Zone. It was in Kansas City, Missouri. And a buddy of ours was actually one of the guys running it. And they did a lot of jerseys and a lot of hats. So it was kind of a combo, but I really liked the way it was set up, but they were a franchise. And I said, well, I definitely don't want to have a franchise. I don't want to pay a franchise fee. We can do this. I mean, we've learned how to be retailers. Let's put our own work, success to work. But how do you start a business? And the biggest thing is you got to find money. And so we put together a business plan just like you would, just like you learned in college, wrote it out. And my business partner couldn't write very well, so I was on the road. He wrote with his toes. But Scott and I put the business plan together, and he reached out to an old professor of his, George Berger. And so George was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He taught Scott an MBA class at Dickinson State in Minot, North Dakota. And so we got together with George Berger and said, what do you think? And he said, man, he goes, I love the business plan. He goes, more importantly, I love you two guys because you're retailers. So people are going to invest in that, right? They get somebody that knows what they're doing. The question is, can you sell hats? And I go, yeah, at this time in the 80s, this is pre-internet. I mean, the internet didn't kick off until about 2000. And then for us anyway, but that was kind of the dawn of the internet. So the question was, will a hat-only store be able to survive? And at that time, Bath & Body Works was big, growing, and they sold $5 bottles of lotion and soap, and ladies would flock in there and buy them by the dozens, right? I went in there during the holidays and get a basket and put them in and bought them for my wife. So I said, specialty stores are, I think, where it's going to happen. People walk in and you're a category killer, and there it is. And I said, men don't have an accessory store to wear. Women can walk in and buy purses and different things like that, but nobody has done the hats. And if you wanted a hat from, let's say, North Carolina, where you're at, I'd have to go to North Carolina. Or if somebody was going to North Carolina, hey, can you get me a hat when you go there? That was always what happened. If somebody would travel somewhere, I'd say, man, give me an Oregon Ducks hat. I love the Ducks. Or give me Alabama hat. Well, you couldn't get those. Wherever you were, you got whatever you got. If you're in Missouri, you got the Cardinals or the Royals or the Chiefs. If you were in Indiana, you got the Colts and the Cowboys were big. Everybody had Cowboys at that time in the 80s. So the question was, could a hat-only store work? And we went about raising some money. George believed in the plan, and so he became the third co-founder in the deal. So that's how we got the third co-founder.
And so you took on the money, and you went, nowadays you think going D2C, you build a website, you start selling online. You went straight to retail. What did your first store look like? Like, what did the early days look like for you?
The funny thing is, the raising money part was one of the best stories. So I'll just go backwards for a second. So yeah. George Berger said, hey, you two guys fly out to South Dakota, Sioux Falls. We'll rent out the public library. There's a conference room in it. We'll have a couple different meetings. So we'll have like a 5 o'clock and a 7 o'clock. I'll invite people. George had done a little VC work, a little venture capital, had a few little things that he had done. And so he invited a bunch of townspeople. I'd never been to South Dakota in my life. So Scott and I go there, and we're staying at a hotel room. We always slept two to a room. So that's just the way it went. We're laughing and we had both brought suits, and we go to get dressed because we stayed at a hotel right across the street from the library. So all we had to do is get dressed and walk across and shake hands and then start telling people what our idea was and see if we could get them to invest money. And so, excuse me, I go to put on my suit and I realize that I have a suit from, I think, maybe my eighth grade graduation. So I had at that time I had no money. I was broke. I'm making $40,000 a year working for Foot Locker, and I'm trying not to, we were doing this sort of on the down low. We can't let Foot Locker know we're doing this, right? We're two of the most respected managers in the central region. We got to be careful. Who knows this? So you're kind of sneaking around. And so I guess in all my haste, I had two suits. I grabbed the one that didn't fit. Not sure. So I couldn't even get these pants up. So I mean, they look like, you know, on the bottom, they were about 3 inches too little. And then on the top, I couldn't button my waist. So the shirt fit, the tie fit. So I took the jacket and I just held it over my crotch the entire evening. So, and then thank God we sat down at a table so that I could sit and nobody could see what was going on. But we've laughed so hard about that. And so that night was interesting because we had somebody that had just sold some beauty salons that came in that had some cash that was curious about what was going on. We had three old ladies that crocheted hats. They thought that if we opened a hat store, that they could sell their crocheted hats, you know, knit hats to us. We had dads whose kids loved hats or they loved sports. So we had all kinds of different people from all walks of life. And when it was all said and done, we raised about $150,000. And I mean, by hook or crook, it was $5,000, $2,500, $10,000. I think $10,000 was the biggest investment. So really, it was more friends and family, even though
like crowdfunding.
It's exactly what it was. Yeah. Crowdfunding was like something. And this is crowdfunding in person, not just online. Yeah. So, you know, we flew back and we had $150,000. So to answer your question, Scott and I looked at each other, he goes, there's no way both of us can do this. So he went and got a job at Target and their distribution centers. We both left Foot Locker. And took on this venture. Scott went to work for Target for the first probably 6 to 12 months. We opened in November 3rd, 1995. So Scott was working at Target because he was a smart one. He goes, we need to understand distribution. So he worked in their distribution department. Target was one of the best even back then. He was big into the software and the computers. So he got the computer system. RICS RICS was the computer system that we used, and Scott knew that we had to, the inventory control was huge, so Scott knew that we had to understand the inventory. So if we're going to sell fitted hats, you better know if you're selling more sevens versus seven and a halves. So it was really important that that we had a good computer system. So, you know, Scott learned about computer systems. He learned about distribution. He worked at Target. I worked at Hat World. I was making no money. I was making $3,000 a month is what I was paying myself. He was making about twice that. So I'm going, dude, I'm working here making half the money of your work, you know. But now what I will say is he worked both jobs. I mean, if he wasn't working there, he would come back there. So we were putting in 80 hours a week. So the first store, we couldn't get anybody. Once we put it together and we had the money, we couldn't get a local mall. Now, we knew every mall in Indiana. We did know every mall in Indiana. But in Indianapolis, where we lived, there were five malls. Castleton Square Mall, Glendale Mall, Lafayette Square Mall, Washington Square Mall, and Greenwood Park Mall. God, I can't believe I know those five malls, you know, 30 years ago. But those five malls existed, and they were outstanding malls. Back in the 80s, the malls were the place to go. And so we went to those mall managers, and they knew us because we ran all the Foot Locker stores. And they go, guys, it's a dumb idea. We're not going to put a hat store in our malls. Finally, one mall goes, you might want to go up to Tippecanoe Mall in Lafayette, Indiana, where Purdue is. There's a guy named David Lee there. Good dude. He runs the mall. He might look, you know, he might put you in temporary and see what you can do. So we drove up to Lafayette, home of Purdue, and David Lee goes, shoot, guys, I'll do it during Christmas. I mean, because during Christmas back in the day, they put temporary stores in there. Pepperidge Farm goes in and sells their sausages. And, you know, you go in a mall and half the mall is temporary for the Christmas season. They're selling stuff that normally you wouldn't sell. So they had a space, an empty space. It was an old dress barn store, and people probably don't remember that, but it was called the Dress Barn. It was a ladies' clothing store, probably not the best name. It went bankrupt. But It was a 4,000 square foot store, and we didn't need, we knew we needed a small square footage spot. So we needed about 1,000 square feet. So we walled off the first part of it, and then we had a huge back room that we didn't need. Ended up, that's where I lived for the first 30 to 60 days. I couldn't afford an apartment. So I lived there. I wasn't married at the time. And so, it was an interesting place. So it was just a plain slat walled store. Cause all we had to do is have shelves on it for hats. And, I had my buddies back here, B-Sync Cabinetry from Cape Girardeau, really from Jackson, Missouri, who build home cabinets. I had them build a few fixtures. They built our first fixtures were the best. They were oak. They were expensive. It looked like something you'd put in your home, but we didn't know any better. We didn't know what fixtures were, and we didn't know, how to go, source cheap stuff. So it sort of looked like home fixturing, but it was pretty wild. The store, we thought it looked great, but looking back at pictures now, it didn't look very good. But, we opened the doors November 3rd and prayed that people would walk in.
And what was your first moment where you said, okay, shoot, like we might have something here. Like sales are going in the right direction. I think things might be taking off.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you, for an entrepreneur and especially a retailer, you pray. We couldn't do it. We didn't do advertising. There was no internet. There was no Facebook. I mean, you could do newspapers or place ads, or you could put a sign on the outside of the mall, but the mall was a draw. You paid to be in a mall. You paid to have a good location because they drew people there, the department stores and stuff like that. So I remember opening the gate 10 o'clock in the morning on November 3rd, 1995, praying somebody would come, just going, gotta. And about 11 o'clock, a lady strolled in with her baby and she bought a Dallas Cowboys shark tooth hat. It was the Logo 7 brand back then that was on field. And she bought a Dallas Cowboys hat and a Purdue hat. That was my first sale. And I think both those hats were like $19.99 at the time. So we did that. And that, I go back to November 3rd. I don't know what day of the week it was on. It wasn't a weekend. I think it was a Wednesday or a Thursday, because then we had the weekend and then we did pretty good. People, the malls were busier on the weekends because kids would come out, and we had a good weekend. And really we did about $107,000 the 8 weeks of Christmas. We didn't know if that was good or bad. It was profitable because they were only paying me. My sister-in-law now, she was a Purdue student. She and a couple of her sorority sisters worked for me for $5 an hour cash. So don't tell the government, but we were just paying cash. And so it was really me on the payroll, and that was it. And so we had not a lot of expenses. The mall rent was a temporary 60-day deal. So January 3rd, our lease was up. So we were just trying to almost prove the concept. We don't have a lot of money in this thing at the time, probably a couple $100,000 and some time. Now we're unemployed if we don't make this thing work. But when I woke up one day, probably 28th or 29th of December, the craziness was over, and I woke up in the store. And the great thing about a hat store is, for a guy, you put a hat on. So I put a hat on, washed my face. I had no shower. So a buddy of mine who was running the pizza joint in the mall, I'd go to his place a couple times a week and shower and get a good night's sleep on his couch. And I was opening the gate one day. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and this was a Monday or Tuesday. And nobody's in the mall except for mall walkers at that time. And here's about four or five suits walking down the mall. And the mall was owned by Simon, and who's still the biggest mall developer out there, a mall owner and developer. They're based right there in Indianapolis, but they owned that mall at the time. And they walked in. So it was the mall manager. It was the brass from Simon in Indianapolis. And they were walking right to my store. I go, holy crap. Somebody told them I'm sleeping here. So they're going to kick us out. Our lease is up in a couple of days anyway. So I go, hey guys, how's it going? And they started talking to me, and they go, hey man, we love the concept. We love the concept. You did some really fabulous numbers for a concept that nobody's ever heard of. We're getting ready to put an addition onto the mall. We would like you guys to go permanent here. And then we've got a bunch of other malls around the state we'd like to put you in. And you could go temporary and just see how it goes. So we got to pick out a really smaller spot at that mall down in the other wing. It was a new wing. And then we went to Muncie, Indiana, which is the home of Ball State, which is an hour up the road. Then we went to Champaign, Illinois, which is about an hour and 45 minutes away, the home of University of Illinois. Then we went to Springfield, Illinois, which was White Oaks Mall. I'll never forget it. And that was a really nice mall over in Springfield, Illinois. And then store number 5 happened to be the first one in Indianapolis at Washington Square Mall. So 95, we had one store. We were able to open 4 more stores in 1996. And so your question was, this is a long answer to it, when do we think we had something? I think when the mall came to us and said, we like the concept. And then we were able to build 4 more stores that following year. And, the stores were doing around $300,000. A couple of them were doing a little bit more. And each store, we hired somebody to work it, didn't pay them a lot, promised them a fun place to work. And if this thing took off, they had a little stock we never dreamed it would take off. So we just hired some good people. We made it a lot of fun. We'd drive around to the stores and take them lunch, and we'd take them and their wife out to eat, and we'd have contests and give away TV, just hokey things, because we thought our business plan was 5 to 10 stores, doing decent business. Scott and I make $100,000 a year and we're happy and we're entrepreneurs. And that was sort of the business plan. So
the maximum, the ceiling was the 5 or 10 stores.
Yep, exactly. That was it. That was it. So, when it really changed is when, and George Berger was awesome through this. When we needed money, he put money in. He ended up having a little bit more ownership based on that, because he was putting the money in. Scott and I had 0 money in. We just had all the sweat equity. And so it was late 96. We had 5 stores open, and 2 guys out of Sioux Falls, Blue Stem Capital. It was Steve Kirby and Paul Schock. Never met them before in my life. These guys, they were venture capitalists, and they were getting ready to start a fund. It was called Blue Stem One. It was their very first fund that they were going to. So they got with a bunch of wealthy guys, and they all put money into a fund, and they were going to invest in startups. And so they came down, and we got in their car, or got in my car, drove them around to all the stores. And they go, hey, if we can raise some money, do you think you guys could make this sort of a regional chain? Maybe get to 30 or 40 stores. We go, absolutely. So they go, hey, we want you to fly up. We want you to pitch this to our group. So we flew up there to pitch this to their group. So this was our first. We'd done it once before in a library with a bunch of townspeople. Now we're doing this in front of people that really know how to invest. So Scott and I are going up there, and we've got some numbers this time to back it up. And we're talking, and these guys are business guys. One guy owned a bunch of drug stores. The other guy owned a bunch of Burger Kings. I mean, these are business guys that, we're going to go into this fund with other business guys and try to make money. And I remember one of the guys stood up. He ran the Burger Kings, and he goes, are we seriously thinking about giving $1 million to these clowns selling baseball hats? And he didn't use those words. He used some other words. And Scott and I are going, oh my gosh, this guy's going to, there's no way they're going to give us money. Well, it turned out we were one of the 5 companies they awarded $1 million to. So these guys invested $1 million in 1996 in Hat World, and they helped us grow. And through the years, they end up putting about $9 million in over about 7 or 8 years. So that was sort of when you had a group believe in you enough to give you $1 million, then you knew we had something.
Yeah. And I know this question might kind of jump us ahead in the timeline, and we can always come back, but I know, the first time you were talking about fundraising, it was, we'll call it crowdfunding for modern day terms. This was an investment group. I believe you had additional opportunities in the future. At any point, were you looking at what can we gain from these investors outside of just capital to guide investors that you're taking on? Like, I know you said Scott early on was working at Target to understand logistics and computer software. Did you find any investors that were able to help you kind of put your head around the corner as you were growing?
Yeah, all these guys. Every one of these guys were great. They were the board pretty much, right? They became the board, and they were really, really good at business. So, you know, once a month and then certainly quarterly, we would get on calls with these guys. And when we had questions, especially about the P&L, about expenses, about, hey, we're thinking about putting in this system. They go, hey, you know what? Let me talk to you guys. We've got this system. I got a guy, you guys are a little bit smaller, but I think this system would fit. Or you're talking about buying racking for your distribution center. I know a guy. And so you use them for everything. There wasn't much we didn't do when it came to spending money or making really big decisions that we didn't use those guys. Later in the process, John Andretti, who was Scott's brother-in-law, Scott married into the Andretti family. But John Andretti was a great business guy. He was a race car driver. He was on our board, and he helped us do a lot of things. So, yeah, we added people to the board that were value adds. We couldn't afford just to add people that would give us money. We needed value adds, and so that was really big. I mean, Scott and I knew retail, but we didn't know a lot of other things. We didn't know about raising money. We didn't know about going public. We didn't know about, you know, the exit strategy. You know, that wasn't really in our plans. We just put our nose down, and we knew about hiring people and taking care of business. I mean, Scott was the back end guy. I was the front end guy. I love people. I love opening stores. I love merchandise. So I ran all the stores, and I ran all the product part of it. And Scotty was good at product. We kind of balanced that off each other, but he was a logistics guy. He was the IT guy. He was the back end guy. And so it was perfect because that's where he wanted to be. And I was where I wanted to be, but no, certainly that's a great lesson for people starting businesses is if you can find somebody that adds value, it's much better than just adding money. Because there's a lot of people that can write checks, but if they can't help you grow, if they can't help you make decisions, if they can't keep you from making a bad decision because they've already been part of a company that went down that road, they go, no, you don't want to turn left there. You want to go keep going straight. You know, you need people that are willing to get in and get dirty with you.
Yeah. And let's talk about the hat industry as a whole, just kind of to look outside of just the hat world, lids kind of ethos for a second. In this time, you say 95, 96, you're growing, you know, in my opinion, very fast. You went from one store to five, and then you're talking about going to 30. What did the hat industry look like? Because I know the shoe industry has always been, you know, a very popular industry, especially with, you know, the music culture and things like that. What did the hat industry look like? Do you feel like it was growing on its own as well? Or do you feel like you were kind of helping lead the charge with that?
No, we led the charge. So we opened store number 3 in Champaign, Illinois. I'll never forget. So when back in those days, we would buy the inventory, we'd load up a U-Haul, and we would drive the counter, the U-Haul, I mean, the product, the shelving, everything in one truck. And we'd go take it to a store, and I would stay there. And I would hire the crew, I would train them, and I'd have to stay there as long as it took to hire a crew and train them. So I was there weeks, and, you know, before I'd find a crew and, you know, walk around the mall and steal people from other retailers and tell them we were the better retailer, you know, come work for us. It's hats, it's sports, it's fun, you know. And then back in those days, you'd find all these athletes, right, college or high school athletes that, you know, they wanted to be in sport. If they're going to work, they don't want to work in a McDonald's where they're flipping burgers. They'd rather sell hats and talk about sports all day. And we had TVs in the store back then, so it was just kind of a cool place. And so store number 3, a kid walks in, he goes to the University of Illinois, and he goes, man, this looks just like the Lid store back in Boston. And I go, the hell are you talking about, Lid store? I've never heard of a Lid store. He goes, yeah, Lids. Have you ever heard of Lids? I go, no. So Scott and I made a few phone calls, found a buddy of mine who was doing at the time called the Perfect Curve. He did it was a device that you put your hat on and it would curve the bill of a hat. And we sold tens of thousands of those things, by the way. But Greg Levins, I mean, I'll never forget the kid. And he's from Boston. He goes, yeah, there's a company out here started by a couple kids that sells hats on carts, like a temporary kiosk kind of thing in malls. And so Scott and I've never been to Boston in my life. We flew to Boston. At that time, they had about 11 or 12 stores. We went around to every one of their stores. And I told Scott, I go, wow, these guys are doing sort of the same thing we're doing. Now, what they weren't doing, they weren't carrying the breadth of hats we were carrying. They were more into local and just killing local. So Boston Celtics, they'd have 50 different Boston Celtic hats. You know, for us, we'd have every NBA team. You know, so we had a little bit different philosophies, but they had a ton of money. Their two fathers, one of the fathers was a billionaire, a retail developer, a mall developer, and the other guy, I can't remember what he was in, real estate or something. But these two, they had tons of money. In fact, they kicked this thing. It was two young college kids, but they started out with $20 million in VC money. So they hired, you know, the CEO from Brooks Brothers. They hired, you know, the COO from Reebok. And so they were paying hundreds of thousands in salaries to people. You know, their CEO was making more than our entire, you know, 30 people working in our stores at the time. So, and they hired buyers from different places. So they had systems that were way bigger than they needed for what they had. And their goal was they saw this internet.com boom coming in the 2000s, and they wanted to go public, and that was their deal, right? And so, once we found out that there was somebody else doing it, it was sort of a race for real estate, except that they had a lot more money. So between Lids at the time and Hat World at the time, they sort of went coast to coast, and we kind of carved out the Midwest. And they were able to afford great locations in great malls. We were able to afford good locations in good malls. And so they were much better at the mall game. We were much better at the retail. We felt like we knew what the customer wanted better than they did. And so as we grew and they grew, there's no doubt we together absolutely created the hat industry. It wasn't Foot Locker, and it wasn't anybody else. You look at all these stores now, Vans or skateboard shop, you look at anybody and they have walls of hats. Travis Matthews right now, what a great golf brand. They have tons of hats. Back in the day, none of those retailers had hats. Hat was an afterthought. It was like a sock. They had one little rack of socks. You know, now you got places that have thousands of pairs of socks. So we sort of went in and created a category and killed that category. So yes, no, the hat business back then was a rounding error. It was a point something of some. Back at Foot Locker, it was less than a tenth of a percent of the business. It was just an add-on. So,
and where were you as a business before the acquisition of Lids?
So we had grown to about 150 stores. That was in 2001. We had grown to about 150 stores.
In six years,
about 150 stores. Just had gotten, it just launched hatworld.com. And so learning the logistics of that, right? Pick and pack, one hat, the whole nine yards. And so people did not want to give you their credit card back then online. No way, man. You were going to steal it. It was crazy, you know. And really, you didn't have all the encryption software, but I think it was a more honest world back then because we never had any issues, right? I don't know. Yeah. But so we were about 150 stores, and we had written a U9 document. We had written the documents to go public. So we were doing a roadshow, New York, Boston, LA. I was on that roadshow. We were talking to different banks about funding this public venture. We were going to sell stock. And Lids at the time had a ton of money invested, and they were growing, but they weren't making money. We made money from store one to 150. We didn't make tons of money, but we made money. We were never not profitable. We were always profitable, right? Lids was never profitable. They never made a dime. So
sounds like the common VC versus bootstrap.
100%. 100%. That's exactly what it was. And we didn't know that at the time. So we were scared them a little bit, because if we went public before they did, they were screwed. And so they called us And I remember Jim Harris, who was our CEO at the time, Ken Coker was the CFO, myself and Scott Molander. The four of us flew to New York City to meet with their VC folks, right? JP Morgan, their guys. And I'll never forget it. First trip to New York, we're on Wall Street about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. They invite us upstairs at Wall Street. Now, this is a big room. And this table we sat at, shoot, my imagination, I'm sure it's grown over the years. This table felt like it could have seated 100 people at it. And there was only about 8 of us there. And they brought in food. They had like maids and butlers bringing in food. It was just the typical, you know, high dollar, high end Wall Street kind of thing that I had seen on TV. And here we are, four Midwestern guys, and chicken wings are good for us. Let's go to, you know, let's find a place and grab some chicken wings and cheese sticks or something. And so we sat there and we talked to these guys and they said, hey, we want to buy you guys, or we want to join with you guys, something, because you guys can't go public, right? You know, you guys aren't big enough to go public. We're 400 plus stores. You know, we've got the model. And, you know, we go, yeah, great, but you guys aren't making any money and we're making money. And so we think we can pull this thing off. And they go, no, we need to join, blah, blah, blah. And so they were talking about, you know, if we join the companies together, it'd be a 70-30 sort of split.
70 them, 30 you?
Exactly. And because of the size of the stores and the volume. And so we shook hands and said, hey, thanks for having us out. Good talking to you. And we left and we went and had a beer and chicken wings after that. We all talked and said, man, I'll tell you what, we'll pick up the pieces when these guys go bankrupt. And we were kind of laughing and kidding. We just weren't going to do it. It didn't make sense for us, right? And we had our guys that invested in. They didn't want to do it either. So at the end of the day, we just kind of went about our merry way. And this was probably November of 2000. That's what it was. It was late 2000. January of 2001, about 60 days later, Lids filed bankruptcy. So they filed bankruptcy. JP Morgan said, no more money. We're done. We're shutting this thing down. And so we're sitting here going, oh my God, they really did go bankrupt. What do we do here? And so it was good and bad. It was the bad part was we all had the same vendors. We were buying from Nike and Reebok and Logo Athletic and Puma and, you know, 47 brand and all of these. And we were all buying from the same people. Well, unfortunately, Lids had stuck these guys with about $5 million in debt each. And that was a lot back in those days for these companies to swallow. And so we got together. We go, hey, we talked to Bluestem Capital. And they go, guys, we can't come up with the money to buy Lids out of bankruptcy. So we went to Delaware, where they were incorporated, and we had to be in a bankruptcy court in Delaware. And we bought them pretty much at the 11th and a half hour. We bought them off the steps of the bankruptcy court for about $16 million. They, at that time, they were doing $150 million in volume. We were doing about 40. So they were about 4X us. They had about 400 stores. We had about 150. So they were 3 to 4 times the size. Well, Saunders Karp McGrew, SKM out of Dallas, jumped in with our firm Bluestem, and together we funded it with LaSalle Bank. So we got together, it was like $16.1 million. We bought them out of bankruptcy. And so all of a sudden, the two hat companies that had been growing in the industry became one. And as we sat down and we talked about the name, obviously Hatwell was our name, and shoot, that's the name we loved. But Lids, at that point, they were nationwide. They were coast to coast. And they had more stores. So our tight, you know, or the way we think, well, if we change to Lids, we have to change less signage and it's less money than if we have to change the Hatwell. So and Lids was a great name. I mean, got to be honest with you.
We came up
with Hatwell on a bar napkin. And we thought that was great, but Lids was a great name. And so that's when it became Lids in 2001. And the cool thing about bankruptcy, not cool if you're going through bankruptcy.
Yeah, I'm going to clip just that part. No, sorry,
yeah, exactly. Go ahead. The cool thing about bankruptcy for us was that, and I didn't know this, should have paid attention in my business classes, that is that you're allowed to go in and pick what stores you want. You're allowed to go in and pick the assets you want. And then there's a price. So we went in, and the problem with Lids at the time is they were overpaying for mall rent, but they were getting the best spots, and they were overpaying for their talent. Well, when we buy them, we didn't need their talent. We needed their store personnel, but their front office, we didn't need anybody. So we lopped off a ton of money there. And then we went and shut down about 150 of their least profitable stores. So if they were paying $200,000 rent for a mall in New York City, we just lopped that off. So we were able to, something they couldn't do because they were still in business and they had leases, they had to pay rents.
Mm-hmm.
We cut off all the bad leases, shut down all the bad stores. And when it was done, we kept 250 stores. That's what we paid for. Add them to our 150. And overnight, we had 400 very profitable stores. That's a nice company. And then what happened is the mall developers, Simon owned 100 malls. Well, we may have closed 30 and kept 70. Well, they came back to us and they said, hey, guys, you just came in here and took all the product out. The store looks identical to what it was when you turned the lights off. We'll take your rent from $200,000 down to $40,000 for the next 3 years, let you build your business up. So what happened is we end up going back into all 150 stores at a rent of a fifth of what it was or a fourth of what it was. So all of a sudden those 150 stores became profitable. So we lopped off the top, got all that, you know, all that money that they were wasting out. And we then went back and renegotiated a lot of mall deals. So overnight we became very good and very profitable. And then we went on a growth spurt of about, we opened 100 stores a year, 2002, 2003, 2004. So, you know, we ended up at about 600 or 700 stores around 2004. And that's when we sold to Genesco.
And as you're growing that fast, I mean, you're saying 100 stores a year, you took on quite a bit of stores when you took on Lids. I know your happy place was the people, the building, the culture, building the environment. How did you keep consistency with that? Like, how did you stay people first and build a good culture as you were just expanding that rapidly?
And that is the million-dollar question, because if you can't keep the culture, you can't grow. You just can't. And so, man, I was on the road 200 nights a year. I traveled to every single store. When I hired district managers who would be in charge of 15 stores, I hired people that I knew I could trust, that when I left, they treated those 15 stores like they were their own. And the people they hired treated those stores like they were their own. You created a culture that people felt like it was their store. So if they had so when you merchandise a store in Iowa and you hired a kid in Iowa to run it, and you had a district manager based somewhere that ran the Iowa market, you listen to them. So when they call and say, hey, man, we have a local high school that's really, really big, and I think if we brought in 24 Notre Dame high school hats, and they have to be this gold and this black or whatever, and here's their logo, we would do it for them. We would listen. And so it created accountability. It created people that looked for opportunity. They knew we'd listen. And if it didn't work, then we probably wouldn't listen to you again. So we said, hey, you got to be right, because we can't waste money. So if you've only got a few bullets to shoot. So if you're going to shoot, make sure you shoot at something that you can hit. And so, you know, you created local, it was a national chain that had a local feel to it. And I really believe back in those days, pre-internet, even when we're talking early 2000s, people weren't shopping on the internet. It wasn't Facebook. There wasn't any of this stuff. So the internet was still learning. There wasn't Amazon. There wasn't any of that stuff. So people still shopped primarily at malls. And you had to talk. If you liked the person in the mall, in that store, that's where you went and shopped. If you liked how they treated you, that's where you shopped. If you liked their return policy, because if something didn't fit, they took it back, and we did. We were customer first. We were people first. And that's the only thing that mattered. We didn't focus on the volume goals. We focused on the people goals, because if you focus on the volume goals, then you make decisions that when you focus on the top line and the top and bottom line, then you take your eye off the ball, you know, as far as what'll get you to that point. And to me, we never took our eye off of the people part of it. And that's that, to me, that was the most important thing we did. And everything, we had meetings where we'd invite all the managers back. So we'd spend money doing that. We get the vendors involved. And you know, the vendors, I mean, I'll never forget, they didn't want to sell to them. When we bought lids, they did not want to sell hats to us because they had just eaten. They got 3 cents on the dollar is what they got in this deal. So if lids owed them $5 million, all they got from bankruptcy was about $150,000. So they were pissed at us, but we weren't lids. We were Hat World buying lids. And so I had to go to all those vendors. And then so many of these guys are my friends today. And I said, guys, here's the deal. We will make that up plus more if you guys go with us. Say, let's grow this thing. We know how to grow it. They didn't know how to grow it. We don't have a lot of heavy salaries. We do it the right way. Grow with us. And so it took a little time, but they did. And shoot, these guys, I mean, you know, at the end of it, we were doing a few $100 million with New Era. We were doing, you know, $100 million with 47. We were doing, you know, $60-80 million with Nike. I mean, we made that up and then a lot more. And we put a lot of small companies on the map. You know, Top of the World was a small company out of Norman, Oklahoma that ended up being one of our best vendors. We ended up doing our best year, 15 or 20 million with them. Zephyr Graphics out of Fort Collins, Colorado was a small mom and pop operation that we ended up doing 15 or $20 million, just us. And what happened for those companies is when they got their product in a lid store, it legitimized it. And now every sporting goods store wanted to have it. Academy wanted to have it. Dick's wanted to have it. You know, Foot Locker wanted to have it. So we were able to legitimize their brand and they were able to grow their brands. And then eventually they'd get, you know, they got the web and they sold, you know, to the consumer B2C. So, yeah, it was a wild ride for sure.
Glenn, I cap off every episode with three rapid fire questions. Apologies for not sending them to you beforehand, but I like to just kind of have, thoughts off the top of your head with it. So if you had to summarize everything we discussed today into a marketing mindset or even an entrepreneurial mindset, what mindset should marketers or business owners have coming away from listening to you today?
Everybody thinks that, especially with the internet, it's easy to make money. You can log on and Amazon or Walmart will put you in business tomorrow. Everybody, that's how Amazon has grown. You know, I go out and buy a bunch of stuff at a flea market, and all of a sudden I put it online and people are buying it and I'm making money and Amazon's making money. And everybody thinks that making money is easy. And I'm just here to tell you that if you want to be successful, it is not just paint by numbers and do it. It is still hard work. It is still people centric. It is still customer service focused. And I would, and I've said this a bunch of times when I've spoken to people, if you feel like you've got an idea or you've got an itch to be an entrepreneur, take a chance. I mean, especially early on before you really get established and have a family and kids, it's a little tougher. I look at you, you're 28. There's not a better time. I've got a son that's 29. There's not a better time in your life. If you ever have thought about being an entrepreneur and taking a risk, there's no better time because you don't have a lot to lose. And that's kind of where I was at 30 years old. I didn't have anything to lose. And so what the heck? Now, when you have a family and you have kids and college and this and that, you know what? Unfortunately, you're stuck on the hamster wheel of working for a company. And I'm not saying that's bad. There's some great companies out there. But if you're an entrepreneur and you know you are, and you have that itch, do it when you have the chance. Take a risk. Find somebody that you can talk to about it and balance off your ideas. And there are people willing to invest in you. I mean, I just got a call yesterday from a guy that wants to talk to me. I know who he is. He's got a piece of software that he's talked to some local friends of mine that they're putting some money in it, and he wants to talk. So, you know, heck, if beat the doors down, find people that you know that have a little money. And they don't want to work. They don't want to put the time in. But if you're willing to put the time in, if you're willing to put the 60, 70, 80 hours a week in, and they know that, they'll invest in that. I mean, I still think people invest in people. And so if you're willing to do the work, I think there's still a lot of room for entrepreneurs out there.
I love it. And for anyone listening that's in the stage of figuring out what they'd like to do in the marketing industry, is there any role or roles that you think will have high demand in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I just think this whole, the whole social media push, the whole, getting your product out there, getting, you know, it's all of the things that we've been talking about, Facebook, TikTok, there's new ones that are starting up. I think you've got to be relevant. I think it's got to be fun. I think people, I say kids that maybe aren't extroverts, they don't want to be out in front of a lot of people, but they've got that sort of artsy mentality. They've got that design mentality. They've got a little different skill set than I had. Those people are going to be very, very valuable. They know their way around a computer. They know their way around Canva or whatever you're using to create designs. And you just, it's all content and it's all relevancy. I mean, there's 9 billion podcasts, you know, that out there. How do you become relevant? There's millions of people selling hats and that will put designs on them, but how do you become relevant? You become relevant by selling yourself, selling you. And so, yes, I think there's going to be a lot of people behind the scenes that are going to be very important in the future that know how to market people, that know how to build people's brands. And so I think that's going to be very important in the future.
And last question for everyone, tell listeners, where can they connect with you or learn more about you and this new business you have launching?
Yeah, no, I've talked about it. I've not updated my LinkedIn page for quite some time. LinkedIn was fairly new. I don't even know when LinkedIn started exactly, but we were jumping into it, I don't know, 2013, 14, 15, maybe at LIDS. And we were taking classes on how to build your resume. And this was your, you know, this was your business to business sort of thing. Facebook's your fun thing. Then Instagram came along. Then it was Twitter. And then LinkedIn came on. It was more business people, right? Connecting with business people. And so I will update my LinkedIn profile. I will start doing some things on LinkedIn. I'm going to start, you know, going back to what I used to do and talk about some of the things I've done and talk about what I'm going to do. So you can hit me on my LinkedIn page. You can, I don't want to give away everything yet, but you can, that's probably the best place to jump on there. And I got to update all my social channels. I mean, I've had a Facebook page forever, but we'll probably update and have a new Facebook page for this business. Same thing with Instagram. We'll be on there. I'm sure we'll have TikTok. We'll have it all. That's when I have to have some young, talented people helping me do this. But my kids are all over that part as well. So they'll make sure that dad's cool and stays relevant. But I would say LinkedIn's probably the best place to get me. You know, it's funny, I haven't updated my LinkedIn page, really updated a lot in 3 or 4 years. So I got to get back to paying attention to that part of it. But yeah, that's probably the best way.
Awesome. We'll be looking out for it, Glenn. Well, Glenn, I appreciate you coming on today, sharing your journey. It was great having you. And thanks for sharing all this with the listeners.
You bet, Kobe. Thanks for having me on, man. Take care.
And that's a wrap for another episode of the Marketing Mindset Podcast. Our guest brought some incredible insights and strategies to the table, and we hope you feel inspired and ready to take action. Remember, if you don't walk away from each episode with a new marketing idea or strategy, we haven't done our job right. With that said, we love to celebrate those wins. If you saw growth in your career or business from something that you learned on this podcast, please, please, please send me a celebration message on LinkedIn. And don't forget to subscribe to the Marketing Mindset Podcast so you never miss an episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Marketing Mindset.